Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Nartrees podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book. The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914 by Christopher Clark, is a wide-angle history of the diplomatic and political decisions that produced the First World War. Rather than treating the conflict as the inevitable result of a single nation's aggression, Clark reconstructs how a series of interconnected choices, misread signals, and escalating commitments turned a crisis in the Balkans into a continental catastrophe. The narrative follows leaders, foreign ministries, military planners, and alliance managers across Europe as they responded to assassination, mobilization timetables, public opinion, and fears of strategic encirclement. Clark emphasizes the fragility of peace in a system where prestige mattered, deterrence could backfire, and communication was often delayed or distorted. The result is a portrait of a Europe that was highly modern in its institutions, yet vulnerable to improvisation and wishful thinking. The book is valued for its multi-archival perspective, its attention to contingency, and its insistence that responsibility was widely shared across several capitals. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, a Balkan spark with deep roots. Clark places the origins of the 1914 crisis in the long volatility of southeastern Europe, where imperial decline, rising nationalism, and great power competition repeatedly collided. He treats Serbia and the Habsburg Empire not as side characters but as central drivers in the pre-war drama. The annexation crisis, the Balkan Wars, and the growth of militant networks created an atmosphere in which violence and covert politics could intersect with formal diplomacy. The Sarajevo assassination is presented as a trigger that mattered because it landed in a region already saturated with resentment, security anxieties, and competing claims of legitimacy. Clark explores how the Habsburg leadership interpreted threats to imperial cohesion and prestige, and why Vienna could view a limited punitive action as necessary for survival. At the same time, he outlines how Serbian ambitions and patronage ties fed broader tensions, and how other states read Balkan events through the lens of their own strategic priorities. This topic clarifies that 1914 was not simply an accident of one day, but the culmination of recurring crises that habituated governments to brinkmanship and made compromise appear costly. Secondly, alliance politics and the mechanics of commitment. A central theme is how Europe's alliance system shaped perceptions of risk and opportunity. Clark shows that alliances were not rigid chains automatically dragging states into war, but political instruments that leaders interpreted and renegotiated. Yet the very effort to make alliances credible created pressure to signal firmness, offer reassurances, and avoid humiliation. The book traces how states tried to deter opponents while also managing nervous partners, producing a dense web of commitments that could amplify miscalculation. Clark highlights the gap between formal treaty language and practical expectations, such as assumptions about who would mobilize first and what kind of support would be delivered. He also details how military planning interacted with diplomacy, narrowing choices once timelines began to move. In this reading, the crisis escalated because actors feared abandonment as much as they feared aggression, and because each step taken for security could appear offensive to others. The alliance structure becomes a system of feedback loops, where partial information and status concerns made restraint look like weakness. The topic helps readers understand how collective security arrangements can unintentionally increase the likelihood of conflict when trust is low and signaling is ambiguous. Thirdly, decision-making under uncertainty in the July crisis. Clark reconstructs the July 1914 crisis as a sequence of decisions made by individuals and small groups under intense uncertainty. He emphasizes that many leaders believed they could localize the conflict, control escalation, or compel concessions through pressure. Miscommunication, delayed dispatches, and conflicting intelligence created a fog in which governments interpreted the same events differently. The book explores how domestic politics, court factions, ministerial rivalries, and personality clashes affected policy, challenging the idea of a unified national will. Clark also depicts how time pressure, especially once mobilization was considered, turned deliberation into reactive problem-solving. The narrative shows leaders relying on precedents from earlier crises, but drawing the wrong lessons, assuming adversaries would back down, or believing that limited violence could restore deterrence. Clark does not present the crisis as purely accidental, but as the outcome of choices that were rational within narrow frames and disastrous in aggregate. This topic highlights how the same tools of statecraft, threats, ultimatums, partial mobilizations, and secret assurances can become destabilizing when each actor believes it is managing risk while actually increasing it. Fourthly, great power aims in competing strategic cultures. The book compares how major states defined their interests and how their strategic cultures guided responses to danger. Clark examines Austria-Hungary's fear of imperial disintegration, Russia's self-image as a protector and a great power, France's security anxieties and diplomatic priorities, Germany's concerns about encirclement and credibility, and Britain's balancing role and debates about intervention. rather than reducing motives to a single master plan, he shows how AIMS evolved across years of crises and shifting leadership. Strategic culture appears in habits of thought, the prestige attached to firmness, the belief that deterrence required visible resolve, and the tendency to interpret opponents' moves as tests of will. Clark also stresses that modern bureaucracies could still produce incoherent policy because different institutions pursued different logics, diplomatic, military, and domestic. The outcome was a collision of partial strategies, where leaders sought to preserve status and security but underestimated the costs of escalation. This topic helps explain why compromise was difficult. Even when war was feared, conceding in one arena could appear to invite further pressure elsewhere. Clark thereby presents 1914 as a tragedy of interacting ambitions and insecurities, rather than a straightforward tale of deliberate conquest. Lastly, shared responsibility and the challenge to simple blame. Clark is widely known for disputing narratives that assign exclusive responsibility for the outbreak of war to a single capital. He argues that the road to war was built by multiple decisions across Europe, each contributing to the breakdown of restraint. This is not an attempt to erase agency or moral judgment, but a method for understanding how systems fail. By tracing the actions of several governments, he shows that some actors pursued risky strategies, others enabled escalation through assurances or misreadings, and still others failed to exercise their potential moderating influence. The metaphor of sleepwalkers conveys leaders moving purposefully, but without full awareness of the consequences of their steps. Clark's approach invites readers to examine how moral certainty can coexist with strategic error, and how leaders can become trapped by their own narratives of honor, alliance duty, and threat perception. The topic also highlights the historian's task of integrating diverse sources and perspectives, resisting hindsight, and acknowledging contingency. The value lies in a more complex understanding of causation, where catastrophe emerges not from one villainous decision, but from a cumulative sequence of calculated risks that proved incompatible when combined. In conclusion, this book is best suited for readers who want more than a familiar march from alliances to trenches, students of modern European history, policy-minded readers interested in crisis management, and general audiences willing to follow a multi-country narrative. It benefits a reader's life by sharpening how they think about complex causation, decision-making under uncertainty, and the unintended consequences of signaling, deterrence, and prestige politics. Clark's reconstruction of the July crisis makes clear how quickly a localized shock can expand when institutions, timelines, and public expectations push leaders toward irreversible steps. That perspective is useful well beyond history, from understanding contemporary diplomacy to evaluating how organizations behave in high-stakes moments, compared to many single-nation accounts. This book is worth buying because it integrates perspectives across several capitals and treats smaller players in the Balkans as pivotal rather than peripheral. It also avoids simplistic inevitability, emphasizing contingency and agency without turning the story into a morality play. The result is an intellectually demanding but highly readable synthesis that deepens understanding of why peace can fail even when most actors believe they are acting defensively, and why responsibility can be broadly distributed across an interlocking system. If you would like to support Christopher Clark, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.